welcome to part two of Auditorium. It's only during the last few years that massive statistical confirmation has emerged to prove that cervical screening prevents deaths from cancer of the cervix. But all is not well with Britain's screening programme, according to Dr. Jocelyn Chamberlain of the Royal Marsden Hospital in Surrey.
We haven't really done so well as some other countries, notably in Scandinavia, in reducing the incidence of invasive cancer of the cervix, despite the fact that we do some 3 million cervical smears every year.
So the 3 million smears are just not effective?
Oh no, I don't think one can say that at all, but I think many of them are being done on low-risk women, repeating them very frequently, like annually perhaps in women who are least at risk, and we're failing to reach the women who are actually going to develop invasive cancer 5 years hence.
The low-risk women being who, typically?
Typically, young, middle-class women who are very well educated about health matters and actually ask for the test every year, but who are not at risk because there's a definite social difference and a difference in sexual experience that identifies the high risk from the low risk. In particular, I think age is a very important risk factor that's very ignored, and it's the older ones in whom most of the cases occur. Mm.
So older women, you've pinpointed age. What would be the typical profile of a high risk woman?
I would say a woman of around the age of 50 who's never been screened in her life before, probably rather lower class, perhaps who's had quite a large number of children and or terminations of pregnancy, and perhaps also who's been divorced and or has had several different sexual partners.
Is it, however, realistic to try and zone in on those high-risk groups? Should it not be necessary to screen everybody?
Yes, I think ideally that a system that screens everybody is what we should be aiming for. But that's a bit difficult because we've got to share out our resources most evenly between all of the women at risk.
What practical difficulties are physicians having in getting the right people at the moment? What is going wrong?
Well, the older women about whom I was speaking no longer are seeking medical care from gynecologists or obstetricians because they have passed their reproductive years, they're not attending antenatal clinics or family planning clinics. So unless somebody puts the idea in their heads that they should be screened, they're not going to come forward and be screened. And it's really a question of somehow getting at them by health education, or if one knows who they are and where they live, one can actually send them an invitation to come perhaps every 3 years, every 5 years.
Now, is this an indication for the computer to get in there and do things automatically?
It depends on the system one's working in. I think that a computer would be very, very useful. And in Britain, we have the possibility of doing this because every woman is registered with a general practitioner, and the general practitioner's lists can be put on computer.
With limited resources, how successful do you think physicians could be in coping with the screening problem?
I think they could be much more successful than they are being if they actually did every woman 5 yearly instead of a few women annually. That way we would actually prevent many more cases of invasive cancer.
The ideal interval then, in your view, should be 5 yearly?
It depends on how much resources you've got. I mean, perhaps the ideal interval is 1 yearly. Personally, I only get screened every 5 yearly. I don't consider that it's worth my effort and worth my while to actually seek it out every year because I think I'm fairly low risk.
But this might vary, and there is room for opinion on this interval of screening.
Yes, there is, and there's beginning to be a bit of evidence coming out that perhaps 3 yearly screening will pick up a sizable proportion of cases that would be missed by 5 yearly. But even so, that is a minority of the cases when you compare it with the women who are never screened at all.
So, two cheers there for the British screening programme from Dr. Jocelyn Chamberlain of the Royal Marsden Hospital in Sutton in Surrey. She's a specialist in community medicine with the South West Thames Regional Cancer Organisation. By the way, if you have any thoughts on the practicalities of cancer screening, we'd be very interested to hear from you. Just jot down your comments on the prepaid reply card and send it back to us. Your ideas will help us with future programming on this very important subject.
A rare species of frog has made the headlines. The Australian gastric brooding frog, feared to be extinct, but now rediscovered in Queensland, raises its young in its stomach and delivers them by regurgitation. At the University of South Australia, scientists are trying to find out why the tadpoles are not digested by gastric juice. They believe their research may lead to new ways of treating peptic ulcers in humans. A possible explanation that springs to mind is the protective action of mucus, akin to that observed in the human upper gastrointestinal tract. We already know, of course, that part of the ability of carbenoxolone to heal peptic ulcer is due to a strengthening of the mucosal barrier and an increased production of mucus. A healing action has also been demonstrated in the esophagus in patients with reflux problems treated with pyrogastrone. Esophagitis, inflammation, erosions, and ulcers have been shown endoscopically to heal after pyrogastrone therapy. Pyrogastrone tablets are designed to protect the esophageal mucosa with a coating of buffer and acid to reduce acid and bile aggression, to suppress reflux by forming an alginate raft, but above all, to give positive healing of the inflamed mucosa. A recent pyrogastrone study showed that rapid relief of symptoms of reflux esophagitis was followed by sustained post-treatment relief lasting for 10 weeks in most patients. This is much longer than might be expected from purely symptomatic treatment, and could be explained by the healing properties of pyrogastrone observed endoscopically. Pardon? Gastric brooding frogs need to regurgitate to reproduce. So for them, pyrogastrone could be bad news. But it's good news for patients with esophageal reflux problems. For them, pyrogastrone can give short-term and long-term relief.
Now, does stress cause heart disease? There's no definitive answer yet to this question, but at the Royal Postgraduate Medical School at Hammersmith Hospital, a team led by Dr. John Deanfield decided to look for so-called silent myocardial ischemia as a result of mental stress. This was made possible, Dr. Deanfield told Peter Goodwin, by using ambulatory ECG monitoring and isotope imaging techniques.
We've been looking at the effects of different sort of stresses that a patient may be exposed to during his ordinary daily life out of hospital, and to see how it affects the blood flow in his heart when he has coronary artery disease. The traditional approach to coronary artery disease is to regard it as a disease which causes angina and is triggered by exercise. We now know from earlier studies in which we record the electrocardiogram continuously out of hospital that many similar episodes of ischemia may occur without angina, in other words, be undetected by the patient during their ordinary daily life. It's shortage of blood supply due to narrowings of the coronary arteries, which can cause angina. And we now believe that in addition to causing episodes of chest pain, which the patient detects, it may cause many other similar episodes, but which are undetected by the patient and are silent.
Now, how did you find out that the heart is at risk even when you've not got pain?
Well, we looked at the typical electrocardiographic changes that you see during an attack of angina, and saw that if you recorded the patient during his ordinary activities, he was suffering from many other episodes of identical electrocardiographic changes, but which were not accompanied by chest pain. Now, we were concerned about whether these were important and have validated those episodes as being due to transient changes in the blood flow of the heart with nuclear techniques in hospital. So we are confident that in patients who have angina and coronary disease, these truly represent disturbances of blood flow in the heart.
What sorts of mental activity triggered these rather alarming changes?
Well, we were particularly careful not to overstress the patient, but to try and reproduce things that the patient might be doing many times out of hospital. And we merely asked the patients to do some simple mental arithmetic to subtract 7 from 100 as fast as he could. And that was sufficient in 3/4 of our patients to trigger abnormal changes in blood flow.
Now that sounds really rather worrying.
Well, it is true then, and it may be that mental activity changes are important in the genesis of problems in patients with angina and coronary disease. It remains to be established how important the mental activity changes are in in relation to the activities that we more traditionally associate with angina, in other words, physical activities, but this is an important research area in the future.
Well, that's for patients with angina who already have symptoms of heart disease. What about, say, middle-aged people who may well have heart disease but not yet know about it?
It is possible that patients who have a coronary artery disease but do not have angina are suffering from silent episodes. This is completely unknown and is another area, another group of patients, which it will be important to study in the future, because the implications of not having any ischemic episodes and having many episodes but which are silent are obviously very different.
And you've got some special equipment that is capable of measuring this sort of episode, haven't you?
We have tape recorders which can record the electrocardiogram continuously, and these are widely available now, which can record the electrocardiogram continuously out of hospital during normal activities. The only special expertise which a few centres now have developed is to analyse not merely the rhythm of the heart, which is the standard piece of analysis done on these recordings, but also the ST segment changes, which we characteristically associate with myocardial ischemia. It may be that these will have important implications regarding the activity of the patient's disease out of hospital and also the need for treatment. But at the moment, those studies are ongoing and it's not yet established. So I think at the moment we don't need to do anything.
But cut out the arithmetic.
Cut out the arithmetic, perhaps.
Dr. John Deanfield, who now works at the Great Ormond Street Hospital for Sick Children in London. And it may interest you to know that he'll shortly be reporting on the effect of cigarette smoking in causing these attacks of silent ischemia.
In a survey just completed on behalf of Winthrop Laboratories, 1,000 general practitioners were asked about their experience of treating primary menorrhagia, defined as having no apparent organic cause. At the same time, by arrangement with their doctors, 50 primary menorrhagia patients were interviewed in confidence about their own experience. One of the most striking, but not perhaps unexpected, findings was the long delay in seeking medical advice. 2/3 of patients said they'd waited more than 6 months, and half more than 10 months, in spite of widely reported physical and social disability, often accompanied by pain, anxiety and irritability. Clearly, a large number of women are in need of prompt treatment by the time they present. When a diagnosis of primary menorrhagia is confirmed, the need for a predictably effective medical treatment can be met by Danol. A study using objective measurements of menstrual loss in such patients has shown effective reduction in all those given Danol 200 mg a day, and a reduction to below 60 mL per month, the accepted upper limit of normal, in 80% of patients. Other benefits reported with Danol were significantly shorter periods, relief of dysmenorrhea, and for many patients, the prospect of continued benefit for some months after treatment. Danol, predictably effective primary treatment for primary menorrhagia.
A fascinating cohort study of sickle cell disease is going on in Jamaica, centred at the Medical Research Council's laboratory at the University of the West Indies near Kingston. Peter Goodwin's just returned from Jamaica and a visit to their MRC lab.
Yes, Sue, and what an amazing laboratory it is. I certainly had my eyes opened, I can tell you. The cohort study is quite unique because a large group of children are being investigated from birth and there's meticulous follow-up throughout life. The laboratory's director, Professor Graham Sargent, explains that the study has turned up a number of very hopeful findings. The first one was the observation that people can have the full set of genes for sickle cell disease and yet not be very ill at all.
What we've realised over the years in Jamaica, or what is now being realised much more widely elsewhere, is that sickle cell disease is also compatible in some people with an extremely mild clinical course. With the increasing screening that was done in populations in the States in the last 20 years, there have been one or two embarrassing events, like when they screened recruits to the Marines and they found four cases of SS disease on active service in the Marines. And this just sort of illustrates the problem. What we found when we first arrived in Jamaica, and we came here for a year in 1966, so we've rather overstayed from that sense, What we found was that there were many patients with the disease who were 30, 40, 50, and I can now say even 60 years of age, who also had sickle cell anemia. That's the severe form, or the generally severe form, where you inherit the sickle cell gene from both parents. They had that disease, and they had virtually no problems. Now, what we realized then is that really sickle cell disease consists of a very broad spectrum. At one end, there are children who are severely affected. They have a mass of problems related to sickle cell anemia and possibly death in the first year of life. To, at the other end, people who, in fact, are very well and have virtually no trouble from their disease. They all have sickle cell disease. So it is not just the fact that they have sickle cell disease. It is clearly that there are other factors, possibly environmental, possibly other genetic factors, that influence expression of the disease. Now, there's a feeling about genetic disease that, you know, you sort of sit back and say, well, the whole thing's hopeless, of course. There's nothing we can do about the genes. So you're stuck with whatever you've got. But it looks as though the fact that you have sickle cell disease itself is not that serious. It is whether you actually get complications as a result of having sickle cell disease. Now, if our patients can survive without complications, then they can have a very reasonable quality of life. So really, the burden of the work of the unit, this is the MRC laboratories that we're talking about here, the burden of the work over the last 10, 15 years has been to try and understand the factors that determine expression of the disease, because these would be more manipulable. You can do nothing about the genes, but if you can find out environmental factors, aspects of the diet, you know, a whole variety of things, immunization, better public health measures, this sort of thing, if you can identify the factors that ameliorate the disease, that make it more mild, then you can perhaps have a marked impression on its expression.
The team in Jamaica wanted to avoid getting a biased view of the disease by seeing only those sickle cell patients who actually suffer symptoms, and that's why they set up their cohort study. This involved screening all of the children born at a large maternity hospital, the Victoria Jubilee, over a number of years. Cord blood was tested for sickle hemoglobin by electrophoresis. Babies don't usually suffer sickle cell symptoms until they're at least 6 months old, because they have enough fetal hemoglobin until that age to protect them from overt disease. But the sickle-affected adult hemoglobin is nevertheless present, so the simple screening test detects every case of the disease.
The objective at the beginning of this study was to screen 100,000 consecutive deliveries and to pick up every single case of the different sorts of sickle cell disease, and to also pick up some normal Jamaican children and use as controls, and to follow these all prospectively in special clinics at the hospital. So that has been achieved. We screened 100,000 children. It started on the 25th of June 1973, and we passed 100,000 on the 27th of December 1981. So it took 8.5 years to do this, even at an institution like Victoria Jubilee. And we ceased to admit children to the study at that time. So our children are now aged between 3 years and 11 years, and we are learning an enormous amount from this cohort study of sickle cell disease.
Out of the 100,000 children tested, only about 1,000 are being studied, half of these with sickle cell disease, the others as controls. And tireless efforts are made to keep track of all the patients. They're encouraged to telephone or call and see Graham Sargent or his colleagues at any time of the day or night. And there's a special fund to pay for bus fares, meals and so on for people who might otherwise find it too costly to get to the research centre's clinics. Apart from the finding that many patients are quite healthy, a number of other important clinical observations have been made about the life-threatening complications.
We've found complication that is very, very serious and previous to this study was hardly recognised at all. This is called acute splenic sequestration. The spleen suddenly enlarges. Now, that wouldn't matter if the spleen didn't actually take off all the blood as it enlarges. So what happens is every time the blood goes through the spleen, it takes off the red cells, and the spleen gets a bit larger, and the next time the blood goes through the spleen, it takes off more red cells. And as a result of this, these children die with an acute anemia. Their hemoglobin falls from 8 to maybe 1 gram within a matter of hours. The mortality rate is very, very high. And so we recognise that acute splenic sequestration is a major problem. The next thing is to try and work out what causes it and how best to treat it. And the end result of all these studies is that we still have no idea what causes acute splenic sequestration, but we do know better how to treat it. The most important thing is to get the child up to hospital as quickly as you can, because transfusion will always relieve the symptoms. Now, these attacks tend to be recurrent, and the way to prevent further attacks is to actually take the spleen out surgically. So we've done trials of splenectomy, and those have actually prevented further attacks. The problem with the first attack has been difficult, and Here we've done an interesting study recruiting the parents, and we've actually taught the mothers how to recognise the complication and told them about the significance of it the moment they feel the spleen enlarged to bring the child straight up. And we're just assessing the results of this parental education programme, but it looks as though the mortality has been markedly improved by this programme.
Acute splenic sequestration affects mainly infants, but in older sickle cell children between the ages of 5 and 10, the hypersplenism can take on a more chronic form, which is also life-threatening. Dr. Alan Emond at the MRC unit has developed a number of lab tests which pinpoint those hypersplenic patients whose spleens are actively sequestering red cells, and this is the danger signal which prompts the team to opt for splenectomy.
The main objection to splenectomy is that there is an increased risk of infection, particularly in the first 3 years after splenectomy. So we've developed a protocol of prophylaxis postoperatively with vaccines, pneumococcal vaccine and Haemophilus influenza vaccine, and the use of prophylactic penicillin. And using this prophylaxis protocol, we have not lost any children from the effects of splenectomy.
The red cell sequestration is caused partly because the sickle-shaped cells get lodged in the spleen's filtration system and are removed from the circulation. Taking out the spleen brings dramatic benefits.
Growth, I think, is the most dramatic effect following splenectomy. Is the child who, for years, has been using all his energy for protein synthesis into making red cells to keep up with his chronic sequestration, now has some spare energy for protein synthesis for growth, and the growth in the year following splenectomy is very dramatic, and it allows these children to catch up and removes a large drain on their metabolic reserve.
It's emerging that controlling the various complications of sickle cell disease can keep patients in quite good health with near normal life expectancy. And another important question about a life-threatening complication has also been answered recently by Professor Sargent's cohort study.
Basically, in sickle cell disease, you destroy your blood much more rapidly than normal. Because of that, you have to actually produce blood much more rapidly than normal. So the bone marrow actually is undergoing much more rapid turnover. Now, there is a condition where the bone marrow suddenly cuts out completely. It's called the aplastic crisis. And what happens with these people is their hemoglobin just drops day by day by day. All the blood that is being destroyed is no longer being replaced. This complication is a transient aplasia of the marrow. It just lasts 5 to 10 days. But the problem is, if their cells, their red cells, only survive 10 days, then they may have no blood left by the time the marrow starts to work again. We have never known what was the cause of the aplastic crisis. It was known to be an infection, or almost certainly an infection, because it went in families, it went in epidemics, but nobody knew what the organism was. And in fact, this is illustrative of the way in which we collaborate with groups in the UK. There's a professor at King's College Hospital called John Patterson, and he actually discovered that in England, it looked as though some cases of aplastic crisis were related to parvovirus infection.
And this was confirmed in Jamaica. So a veterinary disease has been implicated in this specific human illness. Having identified the causative agent, it's now possible to contemplate preventing the aplastic crisis, or at least mitigating its effects. Yet another life-threatening infection for sickle cell patients is the pneumococcus, which can result in overwhelming septicemia. And since the late 1970s, a vaccine has been available. Dr. Anthony John at the MRC unit has compared vaccine with prophylactic penicillin to protect under 3-year-old SS patients from pneumococcus. The results?
Children on penicillin did not have pneumococcal infection during the time when they had it. But children with who had been given a pneumococcal vaccine certainly had pneumococcal infections. Certainly from our data that we have, we can say that the penicillin is of use, the vaccine is of doubtful use.
So, a cautious thumbs down for pneumococcus vaccine in sickle cell patients from Dr. Anthony John of the Medical Research Council's laboratory at the University of the West Indies in Kingston, Jamaica. Antibiotics seem to be more reliable in protecting babies until they're old enough to fight this infection. Penicillin resistance isn't a problem yet in Jamaica, but elsewhere, alternative antimicrobials could be substituted if necessary, says Dr. John. A great deal more will be learned about sickle cell disease from the Jamaican patients as they grow into adulthood and in the years ahead through their natural lives. One of the emerging and very hopeful findings is that if each of the potential complications is dealt with, if and when it arises, there's every possibility that the patient will, in most other respects, be quite healthy. So healthy, indeed, that one of the biggest scientific problems lying ahead for the Medical Research Council team is likely to be keeping track of people diagnosed as having sickle cell disease, but who don't ever feel ill enough to bother to see the doctor.
Thank you, Peter. And I think you brought something else back with you from Jamaica.
Yes, Sue. I had some fascinating experiences on the island, and I've made a recording of the Jamaica folk singers, whose songs remind me of the many people who helped me to report on Jamaica's medical experiences. I'd like to say a big thank you, by the way, to all at the MRC unit and the many doctors and other good friends on the island of Jamaica who helped make my visit to the Caribbean so very rewarding.
So, with the Jamaica folk singers, we bring this auditorium to a close, and I hope you've enjoyed listening. If you haven't already done so, please don't forget to send us a very brief note saying that you want to stay on our mailing list and to continue receiving auditorium, in which case you'll be hearing from us again very soon. So, till then, from me, Sue McGregor, goodbye, and very best wishes for 1985.
One chick a food gal come grab me, pass me chocolate in pan him.
Come we go down, oh come we go down, oh come we go down, my soul has started. Come we go down, come we go down, oh, eat a bye banana. Oh,
oh yes banana,
oh, oh,
oh yes banana,
right one.
Oh yes banana, right one.
Oh yes banana,
come we go
down, oh come we go down,
oh come we go down,
my soul has started.
Come we go down.
Come with all our come.